Welcome to Booked, a frantic hand jibe in the literature disco. Here's a small poem. English literature's a sixth form dance. The prefects tell you where to stand. Most people, though, find there's no chance to get within earshot of the band. And dance around the handbags and almost blinded by the flashing lights this week are regulars Miles Kington and Dilly Keane. And moving snake-hipped across the pulsating dance floor are Heels of Fire Mark Thomas and Roger McGough. So, before the smooch and fondle music begins, let's boogie on down to the first round. Fictional murderers. In front of each panelist is a pack of cards. Each card has written upon it the name of a fictional murderer. What our panelists have to do is describe the murderer to their teammate. Once they've guessed it, they swap over and move on to the next card. Easy. The object is to get as many as you can in 1 minute. You can only pass on one card. Roger and Mark, off you go.
Et tu, Brutus.
Played by a bloke with a drink, Oliver...
Oliver Reed?
Yeah, Diggins and...
Oh, Fagin?
No, murdered people, dog, all horrible, talk like that.
Yeah,
and, No, he's a murderer. Fagin didn't murder, he just stole.
Yes, right, yes. Sykes.
Bill Sykes, yes. That's the one.
Oh, right, go on. Thomas Hardy, lady, famous.
Tess of the d'Urbervilles.
Gotcha.
Now this bloke was, there's a musical about him, and he was quite good at shaving people and cutting their throats.
15 seconds.
Bluebeard.
I've got him. I've got Bluebeard. That's
shaving people and cutting their throats.
Oh, I know.
Bluebeard?
I was looking at...
The camp barber pirate?
5 seconds.
I was looking at Bluebeard.
You know.
Yes, time yes, now.
Todd.
Sweeney Todd.
And,
we've finished now.
I see before me.
Macbeth.
Right.
Good. the audience did very well there, didn't they?
They did, very well.
Anyway, Miles and Dilly.
Well, this is a book by Martin Amis. It's set in the capital of London, of England, and the hero, if he is a hero, goes around murdering people. That's all I can tell you.
Pass.
His surname means ability.
Clever.
You go on.
I don't know. He knelt and prayed in a Shakespeare...
Hamlet.
No, the other one, the king.
Claudius.
Yes.
Oh, Claudius, I've seen that film.
Right, it's a film named after some very silent young sheep. Part played by Anthony...
Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, and the name of the man was...
It's too scary for me, I can't see things. I don't know what his name is.
The man, he crossed the Alps...
20 seconds.
Crossed the Alps with an elephant. Crossed the Alps with an elephant.
Lecter.
Man. Hannibal.
Yes.
Hannibal Lecter.
Very
yes,
good.
I have heard of it.
10 seconds.
She was Greek. And she murdered,
5 seconds.
Her husband, Agamemnon. Yes, that's one.
Time's up. And you got none wrong. Because you hardly did it.
Very few right.
Oh, Keith Tallant, you got him wrong.
Oh, yes,
Keith Tallant.
Oh, right.
And now the round we call Beginnings and Endings, Alpha and Omega, William Hartnell and Sylvester McCoy. Two of our panel have been let loose on classic stories and allowed, just for once, to mess about with them. It's their chance to rework a book's beginning and ending. So, Dilly, which work of great literary worth did you rewrite?
I rewrote The Virginian, the prototype cowboy novel, and I'd like some sound effects from the lads here. The sun was already low on the horizon when Wade Gunbutt tethered his horse to a lonesome pine which grew in a dry creek bed in the lee of the soaring crags of Dead Man's Gulch. A coyote howled in the distance. It was good to be out in the wild, where night fell as fast as a saloon girl's panties, and where a man got to do what a man didn't necessarily need to do but did it just for the heck of it anyhows. Wade Gunbutt, who was plumb tuckered from a long day in the saddle, gathered up a few sticks and soon had a small fire going and some beans boiling up. When the steady clip-clop-clip-clop of another horse advancing along the gulch interrupted his mouth organ practice, a tall ring... A tall, rangy-looking man rode into view.
Howdy, stranger, said Gunbutt. The name's Gunbutt, Wade Gunbutt.
How do, Gunbutt, said the stranger. Folks call me the Virginian.
The Virginian, mused Gunbutt, discombobulated. That's an unusual name. Is it short for anything? Was you just christened that way?
Nope, said the stranger. My ma had me baptized Ian Jeremy Julian. But that ain't a name for a manly kind of a man. I wasn't ready for the kind of offers you get when you're called Ian Jeremy Julian, if you get my drift, so I figured to call myself the Virgin Ian.
Well, Mr. Virginian, I'd sure appreciate it if you was to share my beans, said Gunbutt. Tain't nothing fancy nor nothing, but it's good, wholesome chow, and we can brew up some coffee, and hell, we got ourselves a feast.
Then the Virginian tied up his horse and unrolled the blanket that hung from the saddle. Moments later, he heard the sound of hooves drumming in the distance and getting nearer. Gunbutt grabbed his gunbutt, but the Virginian just sat lazily against the pine tree as though he hadn't a care in the world. A young Indian on a palomino raced up through the sagebrush. He pulled the horse to an abrupt stop and looked at the two men. A tantalizing aroma of tomatoes and garlic wafted through the air.
How? Said the young Cheyenne warrior. Pizza delivery, anyone?
And it ends many chapters later. Wade Gunbutt stirred under his blanket, glad to be out in the wild, where the morning comes up quicker than a cowboy's salami. He licked his dry lips. His tongue found a bit of old tomato sauce that had lodged on his mustache, and the taste of that strangely delicious Indian flatbread came back to him. He savored it slowly, marveling at the memory of that queer, rubbery old cheese and those spicy slices of sausage that had got him slavering at the mouth. It had been a long old night. The young Cheyenne warrior's body was impaled upon a large saguaro cactus a few feet off. The Virginian lay dead just up the gulch, face down with his head in the empty pizza carton. It was time to move on. Yes, sirree, he was heading west as far as the west would go. Soon as he got to San Francisco, he was going to start a little place where they sold nothing but that Indian tomato cheese flatbread. He realized that, as it was at the end of the story, he should have been riding into the sunset like all good cowboys. But number one, it was morning, and number two, the sun was on the wrong side of the world, and number three, he didn't want to get those aging little wrinkles round your eyes that you get from riding directly into the sun without any shade but your hat. Maybe he could invent some kind of darkened glass and put it into a pair of spectacle frames. Hell, the world was full of marketing possibilities, he thought, as he rode on up and out of the valley.
Roger, what's your rewrite?
Yeah, well, I've taken T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats and done a sort of little downsizing of each of the cats, so it's the whole lot. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your radio games. Mr. Eliot, we're hoping to flatter by reciting Old Possum's favourite names.
A Gumby cat, as everyone knows, or if not, very soon will, goes by the name of Jenny Any Dots, not plain old Jane or Jill. She's something of a treasure where domestic order will reign. Cleanliness is her pleasure. Below stairs is her domain.
Mr. Mistopheles, magician extraordinaire, can juggle and keep 17 mice in the air. Audiences roar, encore, encore, at the sight of this conjurer's sleight of paw.
Here's someone now to chill your spine, the one-eyed scourge of the foamy brine. Landlubbers all live in fear of Growl Tiger, the privateer.
Meet Bustopher James, gentlemanly sort, cat of fine ales, claret and port. Famous are those white bespattered feet on the posh polished parquet of St. James's Street.
There's many a cat in the cats who's who rue the cat they once did woo. From Felixstowe to Edinburgh, titled cats have held her paw, meowed her praises, sworn true love by the light of the milky moon above. But it's pitter-pat back to her lonely flat for Grisabella. The glamour cat.
Asparagus, the theatre cat, was in his prime an actor. His name on sepia posters bears witness to the fact, or so he says, and who are we to doubt vainglorious Gus? When the curtain finally falls, the same may happen to us.
Rum Tum Tugger is a right rum bugger who does just as he pleases. The sort of puss who makes a fuss, cries, there's a man in the room, then sneezes.
If Sherlock Holmes had been a cat, his arch-enemy would have been not Moriarty or a cad like that, but Macavity, that monster of depravity, the mean and fiendish aristocrat of the feline underworld scene.
I'm Mungo Jerry.
I'm Rumpel Teaser.
We pussyfoot around the town.
Smooth-talking, slinky-whiskered.
Pilferers of great renown.
A history of British Rail would not be complete without the tale of Skimbleshanks, whom passengers would meet on the night train to Scotland in the golden age of steam, when all the scraps were fillet steak and all the milk was cream.
So let's move on to Vox Pops. In this round, we've sneaked up on some, let's call them, people, and we asked them to describe a book. What could be simpler? In this round, the panel have to separate the chaff from the weft. Mars and Dilly, here's your tone point.
Well, it's...
A book with very powerful imagery.
Used by both the political right and the political left.
A political takeover.
I had a friend who suffered from schizophrenia.
Which then goes wrong.
I don't think a particularly good book.
Well, it's...
The aims are...
Not entirely unreal.
I suppose it picks up on fairy tales.
Subverted.
Well, it's...
Got this one central idea.
And thought he was Napoleon.
Who gradually extend their control...
Searching for personal power.
And warn us against the threatening things that could come.
Pretending to look after the interests of other people.
Well, it's... In some sense, it's a satire, really.
Yeah.
It's the last general election, isn't it? fairy stories, politics, all about sides, schizophrenia. Napoleon, is that significant?
I think it is.
Mm. Somebody thought they were Napoleon?
They could have done.
Napoleon of Notting Hill by G.K. Chesterton?
No.
They had a friend who was suffering. Oh, yes.
Oh, God. Well, what can two do against so many?
I think the audience win.
So what was it then?
We in the audience think it's Animal Farm.
Animal Farm, quite right. I think that was quite an easy one, but this is more difficult for Roger and Mark.
Oh, great, we get the A-level syllabus.
You certainly do.
One of the novel's main characters is, to my mind, one of the greatest unsung heroes of English literature.
Noble English hero.
Vulnerable.
Historical novel.
Becomes involved with...
Despicable qualities mixed with...
With these two... Unfortunate young aristocrats who are
shorter than a lot of them.
Sublime heroism.
A strange book for this author to have written.
Certainly the most readable.
It's unlike most of his other books.
It's that mix, that alloy of the two that I find very heartening.
The noble English hero.
Moving between countries, risking their lives.
Substitutes himself.
It shows that everyone can have their day.
And he goes to his death.
He's the kind of writer you feel obliged to call an author.
Who gave that last quote?
I like that alloy. Did you like alloy? Going abroad,
heroes, and did they mention going back and forwards?
Yes, they did.
Between countries, and it's unlike any other book
by the same author.
By the same author. There's two aristocrats that they hang out.
And
one's a hero, but they've got despicable qualities. I'm going to thump for. Train of Two Cities.
Yes, it is.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
A Tale of Two Cities. And the audience were fairly quiet in that one.
Mm. Very good, man.
Does that mean I'm quite bright then?
And now. Let's go forward towards the millennium. Diary entry. Literary lives revealed, exposed. It's brutal, it's fierce, it's diary entry. Roger. On the page of your literary diary and give us some gossip.
It's a continuing saga, Ian, of Ant and Bee.
Oh.
Bam, bam, bam.
Dear Diary, today came the news that we're travelling to London for the literary awards ceremony. B is convinced that he will win the prize for the most lovable character in a children's book and sees the award as his first step on the road to Hollywood. His ambition is to star in B movies. B for Big Ed. B for big chance to see him off. My first thought is to poison his honey sandwiches. Superglue his wings. B for bloated corpse.
This is B's entry for the same day. They love me. They love me, they love me, they bloody love me, they love me. They love me, I love me, you love me, we will be lovely. They love me. Ant coming with me to the Literary Awards. Got to have someone to hold the award while I snog the totty. They love me. I will be a star. Any of them will fall at my feet. Heidi, Anne of Green Gables, they're all mine. Miss Tiggy Winkle, Little Diddle Mouse, Squirrel Nutkin, I'll be sweeping them out of the bed. Only one crib in the day. That bloody wasp came round. For alimony. I demanded a blood test. Fortunately, Ant took me to the hospital as he was going to give blood like a bloody do-gooder. Oh, well.
Dear diary, oh, frabjous day, Kaloo Calais. Guess who won the Oscar for the most popular character in children's literature? Not Thomas the Tank Engine, not Peter Pan or Peter Rabbit, not Willy Wonka, but Ant. It turned out, and it is with great shame that I write this, should the contents of this diary ever be made public, I will offer myself to the nearest anteater. It turned out that B knew all the time that I'd won. Hence his enthusiasm and the great trouble he went to in getting me to the Albert Hall. How I've misjudged dear old B. B for brilliant. B for best buddy.
Ant makes me bloody sick. Oh, God. Woke up this morning between Mr. Tickle and Little Miss Naughty. Oh, had nosebleeds all day. How much pollen did I snort last night? I don't know. Anne's won the award. This is the worst night of my bloody life. The worst night. And that little smarmy kiss. Fortunately, I returned to the hospital to swap her blood samples. He can't wait until the wasp starts hitting him for alimony.
I've just suddenly realised that when I was reading that, I sounded like Mr. Kipling on crack.
Dilly, what's in your diary?
I found, in fact, the Diary of the White Rabbit from Alice in Wonderland. Monday. Very busy day. Decided to keep diary. Rushed out, bought diary, met queen, spotted large female in corridor. Then my wife had four baby bunnies. Tuesday. Morning hectic. Purchased pocket watch so that I can get to places on time. Bumped into large girl again wearing stupid hairband. Very moved by being present at birth of 11 offspring by me out of Pleasant Bunny in the next Warren. Wednesday. In a tearing hurry, off to Roger Honey Bunny, three Warrens down, no time to finish writing this scent. Thursday. Had three families of 5, 8, and 32 respectively, which came as a bit of a surprise. Rush, rush, rush. The Duchess has asked me to bring... Friday. Ugly looking doe landed on my doorstep with family of 74, claimed they were mine. Now I'm off to give the girls in Warren number 12 a jolly good seeing to. Must die. Saturday, 763 kiddywinks arrived, all calling me Pater. No wonder I'm tired. Late as usual, must hurry or I'll miss the fuck. Sunday, tried to count my grandchildren, but lost the plot after 3 million. So, consoled myself by shagging my way all round the valley. No wonder they call this Wonderland. Lewis Carroll didn't know the half of it. Giving up this diary as I'm far too tired.
And so to the interview. This is a round in which literary characters face an interview panel for a contemporary job. So, Miles, which character has been interviewed and for what post?
It's Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice, who is applying for the job of agony aunt at Cosmopolitan. And I'm doing Mr. Darcy, and the editor-chief of Cosmo is Dilly.
So, Mr. Darcy, you'd like to work as an agony aunt for Cosmopolitan magazine, would you?
Work, madam. Work. A gentleman does not work. A gentleman does not need to work. It's enough for a gentleman to maintain his household, be kind to his horses, and firm to his servants.
I see. So you don't want to be agony aunt for Cosmopolitan magazine?
I don't know what an agony aunt is. I do not know what agony is.
I do know what an aunt is. An aunt is an interfering elderly relative who visits you from time to time, either to ask you for money or to inquire why you haven't married and settled down yet.
As a matter of interest, Mr. Darcy, why haven't you married and settled down yet?
Because I've not yet met a young lady who displayed the same interest in me as I display in myself. Would I have to see these people with problems face to face? Could that be avoided?
You would not come face to face with anyone. Generally, the person who gets in touch with an agony aunt is somebody who has a problem which she cannot talk to anyone else about, so she writes to us for help.
She writes to a complete stranger about her own personal problems. Then she is no lady. I could not possibly respond to a female stranger who wrote to me out of the blue complaining about her problems. Has she no mother to talk to?
Very often we find that problems are caused by parents, and they're the last person that they can talk to.
Yes, I can understand that. Until I was 20, my parents refused to talk to me. And after that, I refused to talk to them. What kind of problem do people write letters about your periodical?
Well, for example, here's a letter we received only this morning. It says, Dear Professor Moriarty...
Professor Moriarty?
That's the name of our previous agony aunt. He's gone missing suddenly. That's why the post is vacant.
I see. Pray continue.
Dear Professor Moriarty, please help me. You must. I am at my wit's end and do not know what to do.
Well, she should get married and settle down with a husband. Then she would know what to do. And she would be cured of this excitable tone of voice.
We haven't actually come to her problem yet.
Oh, I see. Well, let us hear the worst.
Right. I am married to a famous man of letters, one of the most successful playwrights of the 19th century. You'd know his name immediately if I mentioned the name of Oscar Wilde. All the world thinks we are happily married, only I know differently. Only I know that when he goes out with his men friends, his taste for all-male company is much more sinister than it seems. Oh, what shall I do? Have I got any chance of changing his secret identity and winning him back from this dreadful man, Lord Alfred Douglas? Well, Mr. Darcy, how would you cope with this problem?
What problem?
You see no problem in a woman being married to a man who prefers other men's company?
You have just described a normal marriage. Of course, in society, a man and his wife must be thrown together from time to time, and there's no harm in this to a limited extent, but I've always taken the view that over-familiarity is a great threat to married bliss. The pair that stays apart is the pair that stays together. It stands to reason that a man will prefer a man's company, for they share the same interests. In my experience, a man sees far more of a woman before he marries her than afterwards.
And is this what you would write to Mrs. Wilde?
It is.
Then you may go now.
I have not been awarded the post, then.
Almost certainly not, but I haven't seen all the candidates yet. As you leave, you'll see another one waiting to be interviewed. Will you ask Mr. Heathcliff to come in, please?
So, Mark, who's in the hot seat for you?
Miss Jean Brodie.
Right.
Miss Jean Brodie has actually passed the interview stage and she's got the job. And the job will become apparent as the thing progresses. I like to call it a piece. if you could start the piece with a small telephone noise.
Hello. Creme de la creme minicabs. Cars in time and in their prime. How may I help you? Cab to the Cat's Whisker, Streatham, pick up outside Porker's, Gypsy Hill, 2 minutes. This is base. Is anyone clear? Anyone clear? Over.
This is 9090. I haven't got a clue where I am, but I have managed to fill the back of the car with chip papers and have purposely broken the handles on the windows. Over.
Carry on. Over. 37 Porker's Hill to Streatham.
9-0 to base. I still don't know where I am or where I'm going. I have accepted 3 jobs that are urgent and are continuing to drive right up the backside of other cars at traffic lights in a hurry and knowing what I'm doing. Over.
Base to 9-0. Continue. Over. 2-0, 2-0. This is base.
This is 2-0 to base. Over.
Where are we, 2-0? Over.
2-0 to base. You were saying Caravaggio's Last Awake lacks classical rigour and marks the emergence of the mercantile class's patronage of the arts. Over.
Base to 2-0. Ah, yes. You're going to be my very best student. Now, the Renaissance in Italy...
No, I know. I still don't know where I'm going, but I'm continuing to make gestures at other drivers. I'm about to pull into a garage, buy three Christmas tree air fresheners and some scalding hot coffee, which I will place between my legs whilst driving at 80 miles an hour. This is 3-1, 3-1. There's no one answering the door at 46 Riffle Road. I cannot find the punter anywhere. No one is here. I'm well annoyed, Bass, well annoyed. And what about the impact of Luther and the Reformation on a depiction of human form? I'm not happy. Over.
3-1, this is Bass. Whereas I am happy to encourage debate, you are fundamentally wrong. However, I accept that some of my drivers will not be creme de la creme.
3-1, 3-1, I'm not having that. I'm not. I'm sorry, Bass. That's bang out of order. If the Reformation centres on a direct relationship between man and God, needing no sanctioned church, the church then ceases to be the object of the art. It therefore follows that the emphasis on the subject matter is the human form rather than the manifestations of institutional symbolism. Over.
3-1, 3-1, 3-1, 3-1, this is Bass. I do not care for your argument or your tune. Furthermore, you are wrong because the address is 64 River Road. Over.
This is 9-1 to Bass. I've got the A to Z out, got my bearings. I'm now heading to the genital burns unit at St Margaret's. Over.
And now we're nearing the end of the literary disco, I'm afraid, so let's take the last dance, stop the plot. I want our teams to apply the brakes and screech the plot of a book to a halt, to red light it. Who'd like to go first?
I've tried to halt the Birdman of Alcatraz. Hey, Ma, you'll never guess what me and the boys shot down this morning.
I tried to stop the plot of War and Peace. Moscow, Shmoscow, Josephine, let's go to Marbella.
Any more?
Yeah, this is trying to stop the plot of The Pit and the Pendulum by Edgar Allan Poe. I don't know much about pendulum, but all the pits round here is shut.
I've tried to stop the Book of Genesis. And on the eighth day, God said, no, it's not going to work.
Well, it's time to finish now. Go on.
I've just got one more which I'd like to punt.
Go on, then. You punt it.
This is The Old Man and the Sea, which is Hemingway. The fisherman stood on the bright white sun as he read the letter from the European Common Fisheries Committee. Three quotas.
Well, it's time to finish now with a poem. The literary dance is over, the couples drift away to each other's rooms for coffee and biscuits on a tray, and bookish talk and poetic chat, and a swapping of sonnets in a studio flat, and a hand on a knee, and then remove it, please, because these are what you call writer's knees. So it just remains for me to thank Mark Thomas, Roger McGough, Miles Kington and Dilly Keane. Researched by Felicity Goodall, devised and produced in Bristol by Mark Yobst, and presented by me, Ian McMillan. Goodbye.